We took it all. We brought them to our land. An endless night. Ember hot and icy cold. The rage of the earth. We made this curse. Carved it in the blood on our backs. We did not see. We could not, but she did. And in the end...
What will I become?
Senua Saga. Hellblade 2.
Play it now with Game Pass.
Hello everyone and welcome to ESPN Cricket Vote Power Play. I'm Valkyrie Baines and I'm joined by my co-host, Fenos Wunder. Last year, we brought you a load of conversations with some of the leading players in women's cricket. Now we're back with a new podcast name, a new logo and our very own platform. But we've still got the very same commitment to bringing you fascinating discussions with the game's superstars.
We also plan to explore and challenge some of the power dynamics within the sport and discuss issues of particular relevance to the women's game. This will include conversations around scheduling, pay, and equality in the game, as well as all the fun of playing, watching, and living live sport.
This is ESPN Cricinfo Power Play, Women's Cricket Uncut.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to another episode of ESPN Cricinfo Power Play. This is a particularly special episode because it is the women of the Royal Challengers Bangalore who have managed to go where the men have not. 16 IPLs they've played and they haven't lifted a trophy. This is just the second Women's Premier League. And RCB became champions after a really poor season one. But then they surged back. They had some really close games. They showed us some of the best of both the Indian and the foreign contingent. And they were the ones who lifted the trophy at the end. Here on Power Play Podcast, we were so fortunate. We've got a champion in our ranks. We had an amazing conversation with RCB and New Zealand's Sophie Devine that we're going to take a listen to now. Thank you so much for coming on to Power Play Podcast, Sophie Devine. We're very happy to have you with us today. You're fresh off the WPL. The second season has taken place, and I think we'll all agree that it was a very exciting tournament this time around. We saw some real nail biters and some really interesting performances. How's your experience been this year compared to last?
Yeah, it's certainly been an incredibly exciting tournament. A lot of close matches, which hasn't been good for my grey hairs sprouting out, but I think it probably just shows the evolution of the tournament, and that's what you find with a lot of these franchise leaguers. Season to season, they grow, they develop. I think the skill level has obviously increased. I think just even little things that go on behind the scenes in terms of, the crowds that they've had, I think have been fantastic. Obviously in Bangalore, they are outstanding, and here in Delhi as well. So I think it's been fantastic to see that the marketing has really improved. I think just the general organisation, people are a lot more aware of what's going on, and it's, you know, another year older. So as a tournament, I think it's been fantastic and can't wait to see, you know, how it continues to grow.
Yeah, and personally, I mean, you've played a little bit lower down the order for the last couple of T20 tournaments now. What has that been like for you? Is it an adjustment to the role, or have you just sort of seamlessly got into it?
I think it's always going to be take a bit of adjusting, but that doesn't matter where you bat for me, and whether you're opening, whether you're in the middle order or down the lower order, there's always going to be adjustment to situations. So for me, it hasn't been too much. I think it's just been adapting to the situation that I find myself in. I think with opening, you know exactly where you stand. You're going to face the new ball. Two fielders are up, whereas I guess batting sort of 3, 4, 5, it could be in the power play, it could be in the middle order, it could be late in the innings. So you've got to be prepared and be able to adapt and adjust quickly to what's required at the time. But I think, you know, it's a really exciting challenge for me. Obviously, having played for a while now, you're wanting to keep evolve and develop your game. So it's been cool. I think, I look around the world and try and see what the best players are doing. You look at sort of Nat Sivabrant, I think has always been, you know, the absolute front runner in that space. So to look at what she sort of does and how she constructs innings through that middle order is probably something that I, you know, not model my game on, because I think I'm a different player to her, but certainly how she can construct an innings and manage run chases in particular, I think is something that, you know, I really admire.
And so you've mentioned Nat Silverbrand. She's, of course, at the WPL and missed or will miss a couple of the games of the New Zealand series in order to do that. We had a chat with her, actually, in our inaugural episode on this podcast about what that was like, the decisions behind it, obviously the major, major financial incentives of the WPL. Have you been following the story and just, you know, do you have any opinions on how that's worked out?
Oh, yeah, look, I guess I've certainly been following it because we're playing against the English. So, you know, sort of part of me is quite happy that we don't have a couple of those English players. They'll obviously still be tied up, but I think it's going to be a conversation that's going to have to keep occurring with these franchise league popping up and the schedule getting more and more condensed. Is that there's going to be overlap? I mean, we've seen it in the men's stuff now for a number of years that people are in and out of competitions. International cricket is, you know, trying to find that right balance of still being relevant with the different formats. I still think in the female game, in the female space, that I think there's space for everyone. Obviously, it's going to take a bit of a give and take, but I'd really hope that people and competitions and boards can, yeah, I guess, be a bit flexible in terms of allowing space for each competition as well as international cricket, because I think that's really important for the women's game is to keep that driving forward. So, look, it's unfortunate, but I think it's going to be a part of our landscape moving forward, and it's going to be dealt with differently with each team. So, yeah, it's an interesting one, but I can also understand both sides.
How did you sort of approach the decision on what to do in terms of, you know, if you guys are in the final versus, you know, having to or versus, you know, going back home? How did you sort of weigh it up in your own head?
Yeah, it's been a really interesting one. And New Zealand cricket have been fantastic, and this has been a space that I think they've been excellent at for a number of years in terms of allowing a lot of us Kiwi players to go and play in these franchise leagues and to experience that. And they've always been really upfront and honest in terms of allowing us that time to go off. And if there's any clashes, then our, I guess, loyalty can lie with the franchise. They obviously work incredibly hard to make sure that there isn't any clashes with international cricket. And I guess my priority is always to try and play international. But if I've signed a contract, then I guess legally I'm bound to front up for that and hope that there is no clashes. But yeah, again, like I mentioned, I think everyone's going to deal with it slightly differently, players, boards, franchise owners. I think, yeah, at the end of the day, it's what you're comfortable with and, yeah, having those discussions with those people that need to have them.
And what are you expecting of the England tour, in terms of sort of them as an opposition, but also, you know, the development of the New Zealand women's side in recent times?
Oh, look, I think it's a great opportunity for us. I think we've got a pretty tough 12 months coming up facing England twice. Then we've got India and Australia as well. So chucking a World Cup in there too, and it's going to be a pretty full-on 12 months for the White Ferns. But I think it's a really exciting challenge. I think you know, I guess it's been spoken a bit about, there's been changes on our contract list. We've had a lot of new players come into the fold. We've had a lot of younger players as well that have sort of tried to make their mark. And I think this is going to be a really good test of us. As a unit, I think we've sort of been bubbling away for, you know, 12, 18 months now. And we might not have had the performances and the results that we would have liked. But I guess for me, being a slightly older head and looking at the bigger picture, is that stuff's going to take time. You're not going to be world champions overnight. And especially when you see the likes of Australia, England, India, you know, South Africa, obviously in the World Cup last year, that, you know, all these countries are striving to be the best. And that's absolutely what we want to be doing. But we also need to be realistic that, you know, we've got a fresh young group in here that hasn't got a lot of experience. We've obviously got a few players. My mate Susie Bates, who's got a lot of experience, but it's just getting that right. And to take on the English is going to be great. Obviously, playing at home, we absolutely love doing that. So fingers crossed we can perform. You know, the girls have worked incredibly hard over the last sort of 6 months, obviously coming off the back of our domestic season. You know, they've got a fantastic A program now against the England A side as well. So there's plenty of cricket, and I know that the girls are just chomping at the bit to get into it.
You mentioned that World Cup in South Africa, and I did want to take you back almost exactly a year ago, and the New Zealand side had suffered two really heavy defeats to Australia and South Africa in that T20 World Cup. And you gave a really moving post-match press conference. I can remember it just so clearly. You know, you were very emotional, very, you know, disappointed in the performance and sort of talking about how, you know, you guys were going to approach fixing those things. Can you first of all sort of talk about what was going through your mind at that time, and then sort of through to what's happened since, and how you feel about, you know, the team going forward now?
Yeah, that's a great question and a good reflection piece. I guess, to be honest with you, it was quite an emotional tournament for me, because I was coming off the back of an injury. It really challenged me in a number of different ways, not only as a player, but also as a leader, in terms of my ability to train was severely impacted. I obviously wasn't bowling, and trying to find ways to impact the group. So when I wasn't able to train and be around as I guess I've been used to, was something that was really difficult. And then I guess having those two performances up front, which really sort of, you know, put us on the back foot and made things pretty tough to obviously get through that tournament. But I think like every opportunity in cricket is there's opportunities to learn and to grow. And for us as a playing group, you know, looking back to last year, we had a really tricky tournament series against Sri Lanka in Sri Lanka as well, where we came up against a side that was super passionate and just, you know, Chamari was nearly unstoppable. And again, just to have a bit of perspective on that as well, it was the first time in the subcontinent for a large portion of our playing group. So I think that's been a real thing over the last 12 months or so, is that a lot of our group haven't experienced playing in the subcontinent or, you know, exposed to playing in World Cups. So trying to get them up to speed. And I think there's been so much work has been done behind the scenes through Ben Sawyer and Liz Green at New Zealand Cricket to provide opportunities for us to learn and to grow as players as quickly as possible, but to also be able to perform at that international level. So again, I'm just really excited to see where this group's at. It's obviously going to be a huge year for us, taking on the English first of all, to, I guess, get a bit of a marker as to where we are. So, yeah, again, really excited to see where I'm. But there's been a lot of hard work that's gone on in behind the scenes.
So if you just to ask you, I mean, you've seen, I guess, it all in terms of New Zealand women's cricket development. And I was just watching this Instagram reel today where you were giving an interview saying when you started playing with the boys, it was actually their parents who were a little bit like, what's this girl doing playing with our sons kind of thing. Now, I don't even think that's part of the discourse in New Zealand cricket anymore. So if you are just taking what you've said in the previous answer and then expanding it, you know, what is the depth of New Zealand cricket looking like? Is there a lot coming through? Is it quite diverse? I mean, we've seen with the men's team that there is a fair amount of diversity coming through now as well.
Yeah. Again, being brutally honest, no, there's not much depth coming through. And that's where we've got to be realistic as a country, is that we don't have millions of people, you know, there playing cricket. You know, although there's been every intention to try and attract players, it's similar to the men. As we're a small country and we've got to make the most of what we've got. And I think, you know, getting that balance right between opportunities is always going to be difficult. We don't have, you know, I think we've got a great domestic setup in terms of the teams and the amount of games played. And I guess I've been lucky to have seen Australia cricket for a number of years, both involved and also from the outside, and see the work that's been put into their domestic setup. And I think that's what has laid the platform for them to be so successful over the last 10, 15 years, is the development of the professionalism of the game and the domestic setup. And we're still a fair way off that. And so I think there's always going to be a bit of a gap when you see the White Ferns and the contracted players and then the domestic players. I guess bridging that gap is going to take time. But that's not to say that a lot of work hasn't been put in through New Zealand cricket. Obviously, I mentioned that the A team is a fantastic start to that and providing more opportunities. We've just recently had a North versus South series, which is, I guess, getting the best of the domestic players that aren't sort of in the White Ferns or are sort of fringe into that environment and to play more cricket. So there's been a lot that has gone on, but I guess, as I mentioned earlier, it's going to take time. I think, you know, it's certainly a selling point when I talk to just athletes, female athletes coming through, that cricket is such an attractive option as a career, because we don't necessarily have big numbers of it in New Zealand. And I guess because rugby union and netball are so prominent in the female space, that cricket's actually a fantastic option to come and play and the opportunities that are available. So look, I think there's a very big picture that's going on behind the scenes, but there's got to be, I guess, a bit of realism and a bit of perspective that it's going to take time. And you know, as long as we can keep chipping away at the likes of Australia or England, you know, I think we can certainly be up there with the best.
It's an interesting reflection you've made there, because I guess looking from the outside and in South Africa, where we've just professionalized the women's domestic game, and I'll sort of put that in inverted commas because it's not really that professional. I mean, we look at you guys, you know, one of the first countries to introduce equal pay, and we think, wow, they're definitely the first world. And from what you're saying now, it looks like there's work to do. But, you know, does it make a difference that you've got equal pay? Girls can be incentivized to make a career out of cricket rather than what you mentioned, netball, which is such a big sport out there. Or is there something else in terms of, like, you need to get girls interested before they think, oh, I can make a job out of this?
Yeah, I think it's all of that, if I'm being honest. I think, you know, it's fantastic. I think it's really important that we're clear that equal pay is on match fees. It's not on the contracts, to make sure that distinction is made really clear. And, you know, it's a fantastic step forward, I guess, at the end of the day. And a lot of what was spoken around with the MOU was, we're doing the same thing as the men, so we should be paid equal amounts, which I think is great. And obviously there's still a lot of room to grow in that area. And we're seeing countries like England in the 100, and obviously the Big Bash recently in Australia, you know, moving towards sort of equal pay in the franchise space too, and with their central contracts. But I think that's one side of it. I think a bigger part, and probably more importantly in my mind, is the resources and the opportunities that are available to cricketers. I think it's all well and good to have money in your back pocket, but if you don't have coaches, if you don't have games, if you don't have competitions to be able to train and to play in, well, it's a waste of time if you're being serious about it. So I think that's a really important part, where you've got to get it right first to lay that foundation to be able to develop and grow. So again, I think it's a huge piece of work to try and get that right, and every country is going to do it slightly different, as you mentioned. For those that, you know, South Africa has obviously moved to professionalise their domestic stuff. Each country is moving at their own rate, which is great. But I think within that, you are going to see some slight differences in terms of the output of that.
Yeah, and I also think the other thing that's so important is having someone to look up to, because, I mean, you would have grown up in that era where, you were playing with boys and the people to look up to were men, but young girls these days can look up to you. And that has to kind of bring us to talking about some of your own form. So I just wanted to sort of jog your memory back to that amazing year you had, 2017-18, where you scored 300s in seven innings in ODI cricket, and you were really, to me, from the outside, like at the top of your game then. Can you talk a little bit about that period and what that was like? You know, what did you feel in the prime of things, and how do you see yourself moving now as you enter kind of mid-30s, which is not old?
Yeah, no, thank you. Thanks for that, actually. it feels like such a long time ago, that sort of period. It's probably funny, because looking back at it, that was probably sort of back end of 2016, 2017. Mentally, I was in a very poor place. So whether that was, you know, coincidence that coming through the other side of that helped with my cricket performance, it's hard to know. But I think we all, as cricketers, want to be consistent. I think that at the end of the day, we want to be consistently performing and contributing to our team. So, yeah, I can't put my finger on that. It was probably a period of time where I felt really comfortable, and obviously had probably had a bit of time away from the cricket environment. So whether that played into it, but again, I think, you know, fingers crossed, I've got a couple more years like that left in me. Obviously, I've been moved around a little bit in the order, so just trying to figure out that and really nail that role for me is something that, you know, I do. I know my form hasn't been as great as I expect, and I guess I'm my harshest critic in that space. So I still feel, you know, I've got a lot to contribute to not only the White Ferns, but all the franchises and competitions and I play in around the world. It's just finding that, you know, that consistency with it, which is a lot easier said than done.
You mentioned there about, you know, you're not sort of being in a great place at that time. And you also took a well-being break sort of toward the end of last year. Can you just sort of talk about a little bit about your most recent break and how you're doing now?
Yeah, well, look, certainly feeling in a much better space now, and it's probably something that I've learned from, you know, the earlier times, sort of 2016-17, and being okay to step away from the game and to prioritise my own health, mental health in particular, to give my best on the cricket field. I've got to be 100% both physically and mentally as well. And probably the most recent time was probably coming off the back of COVID, which, you know, it feels like I've tried to wipe it from my memory As I'm sure it was really difficult in so many different ways for everybody. But for me, I think it probably didn't hit me till a point where I knew I needed to step away again and to make sure I could take a break and, I guess, extend my career. So, yeah, I think that's probably been something that I'm quite proud of, I guess, in a way, is that I've got the ability to step away and to ask for help and support. And again, New Zealand cricket have been unbelievable in that space in terms of providing me the support and time to step away and to, I guess, refocus and reset, to be able to come back. Because as I mentioned, I still feel like I've got a lot to give to New Zealand cricket.
How do you sort of balance now the really big growth in franchise tournaments for women and managing that along with your mental health? Because obviously the two go hand in hand, workload and looking after your mental well-being. How do you sort of see that happening now and going forward as these sort of, commitments only get bigger?
Yeah, it's certainly something that I've spoken a lot with my, I guess, my support network back home in terms of making sure that I get breaks sort of scheduled in, whether that's between franchise cricket or international series. And that's something that, again, is easier said than done with how much cricket there is being played. But it's certainly a priority for me. And if that means I get another couple of days at home, then so be it, because we know, that's going to actually help me towards the back end of a tour. So if I'm feeling a bit fresher rather than sort of going from one tournament, one franchise to the next sort of thing. So that's something that I work really closely with, I guess, yeah, my support network, but also the staff at in the White Ferns is aligning that schedule. So it is, and it's still a learning curve, because there's times where you feel great and you feel like you keep going, and there's other times where it's a real struggle. So I think that's going to be, I guess it's going to be a challenge that female players are going to have to work through moving forward, is that the volume of cricket is only going to increase, and how they manage that. And I guess that's something that I am quite passionate about, is that making sure that players are putting themselves first, and I guess listening to their bodies, their minds, that cricket's always going to be there, but you've got to look after yourself. So yeah, it's going to be a really interesting space in the next couple of years, sort of where that moves to.
I think last time New Zealand toured England just a couple of years back now, I remember you saying to me, we need to normalise the conversation around mental health. Do you feel like we're there now, or is there still some work to be done?
Oh, look, I still think there's work to be done, as everything is, isn't there? I think it's been great having been in the WPL and playing alongside Kate Cross, who's obviously a really strong advocate for mental health as well, and has spoken really passionately about her own journey. And I actually asked that question to her the other day, in terms of, do you think that conversation is becoming a lot more accepted and normalised? And again, she probably reiterated that still work to do, but it's certainly a conversation that's becoming more common, which, whether that's a good thing or not, I'm not too sure. But and I think about the likes of Mila Kerr as well in New Zealand, and players being able to step away and have the confidence and the support to be able to do that, I think it's a really good sign. And I think, yeah, I don't think it's judgment, but that the external voices, whether that's media, whether that's just the cricketing community or whoever it is, seem to be a lot more accepting of that now and understanding. I mean, not everyone's going to understand, and that's okay, and people are entitled to their own opinions. But I certainly feel that there has been a lot of growth in that area. I still think there still needs to be a lot more, education around it and understanding of that, but certainly moving in the right direction.
So, everything you're speaking about is about kind of like holistic health and, looking after the way that we function in the world. And I'm so interested to ask you, and we don't want to make this, just a conversation about health, but I know you are also diabetic, and it's such an interesting and I guess not so much spoken about condition, which affects so many people around the world. How have you managed your advocacy in that, and what do you want people to know about it?
Yeah, it's quite awesome actually that I've got Jess Kerr in the White Ferns, who's also a type 1 diabetic. So to be able to lean on her, and I guess usually it's to have a vent, if I'm being honest, and to have a bit of a moan and things like that if things aren't going that well. It's super nice to be able to, I guess, share that burden with her, and yeah, just to have that sort of support person. But again, it's something that I'm really passionate about. Again, being here, it's been awesome to be able to share, I guess, my journey and educate people around type 1 diabetes. Obviously, Hayley Matthews as well, and Mumbai Indians and West Indian captain, has it too. So I think, again, it's a real education piece and wanting people to learn and understand about it and how we balance it, because at the end of the day, that's what it is. It's the balance of, you know, insulin, food, exercise, and making sure that all works. But, yeah, again, these sort of opportunities to come into these environments and for people to ask questions, you know, I still think people are a little bit awkward around me if I'm injecting or something like that. They don't want to, you know, seem too nosy, but, you know, I'm more than happy for people to come have a look, have a play around with the stuff, because I think people that are better educated are only going to help. And, you know, you never know. I might end up in a bit of trouble and need someone to know what's going on. So I think for me, it's a bit of a no-brainer to sort of be really open and honest about the diabetes.
This is a good time for me to say that my cat, who is 13 years old and called Dusra, is also a diabetic and has to be injected several times a day. So I know exactly what you mean. But so if you just talk about that, I mean, you've got lots of interests, right? We've spoken about health, mental health, cricket. You played hockey before, and you're going to play cricket for a few more years. Where do you see yourself after that? Is it in the space where you're doing a lot of educating? Because that seems to be what you're really passionate about.
Yeah, I'm not too sure. It's a bit scary because I think that time's coming a lot sooner than I realise. But I certainly still want to be involved in the sports space, whether that's cricket, I'm not too sure. But as you mentioned, you know, whether it's mental health, whether it's holistic health, I'm not too sure. But I think there's some really important messages that young athletes, both male and female, can, you know, hopefully be educated on, because the landscape has changed so much just in my time, and it's going to continue to grow and evolve over the next couple of years. And whether I can be in that space, I mean, I don't know. I know I'm going to be hopeless if I'm stuck behind a desk 9 to 5. That's definitely not what I'm looking for. But yeah, I certainly would want to give back to the sport in some capacity, whether that's, yeah, managing, education, coaching. I'm not too sure yet. I've probably got to figure that out sort of soon, but at the moment, sort of just happy cruising along doing what I'm doing.
I guess you've part answered what I was going to ask you already, but just sort of talking about the future and what lies beyond cricket, and you did say earlier, you know, you got a few more good years in you yet, but having that sort of future tours program laid out for you, that sort of thing, does that give you any thoughts about, oh, this is where I want to map the rest of my career, or do you tend not to be looking that far ahead?
Oh, no, I'm very particular about my planning. I've got about 7 calendars on the go that are all colour coordinated and all the rest of it. I think it's always really helpful. I think the really tricky thing is, and we've had a couple of conversations in different teams I've played in, is that there seems to be something every year to look forward to. So it's really hard to be like, oh, yeah, well, I'll get to the World Cup. And then there's a couple, like it's literally this year, for example, there's a T20 World Cup and there's a 50-over World Cup next year. Then there's, you know, potentially a Commonwealth Games. And then there's potentially, you know, Champions Trophy, or I think they're bringing in another competition. So it's really hard to be able to, you know, put a line through a date and say, yeah, that's going to be me done. But I think it's great to have that. I think I'd love to see the IWC expanded. I think there's 10 teams in there at the moment. I'd love to see that pushed out to 12, 14 teams, and to really bring in some more countries there that I think, you know, we've seen already, I guess, whether it's that gap or not, I'm not sure if that's what you can call it, but, you know, the competition is getting closer in that global space. So, yeah, I think for me, I think that FTP is a really important part of international cricket.
Yeah, that's actually something that we've spoken a little bit about on this pod, is that gap closing, and I guess the role that bilateral series have to play in that. And again, against the backdrop of, you know, franchises taking off, where do you stand in terms of, you know, bilateral cricket and a really packed calendar? Would you like to see more of it, so that then players playing in those get an opportunity to develop and get those franchise deals? Or would you like to, do you see franchise cricket as the future? Where do you, you know, sit in terms of bilaterals and franchises, you know, working hand in hand for women's cricket?
Yeah, I think this is where I hope we're in a better space than the men's, as I feel like the men's has almost gone too far, whereas the women have an opportunity to shape that future calendar or schedule. Yeah, and I mentioned it earlier in terms of, I really do hope that boards can have the perspective to still have their own competitions and franchise and stuff, but, you know, to allow players to go in and play in those without being impacted or pulled in and out, and having different players come in and out of competitions and international fixtures. I mean, I would love to see the multi-format series bilaterally put across the board. I'd love to see the IWC move to three T20s, three one days and a test. I think that is the ultimate for me. I think it brings relevance to all formats. It gets international cricket, you know, equal across the board. If countries want to go and play outside of that, then obviously more than welcome to. And then you're fitting in your I guess your franchise windows, which I think are pretty clear in terms of you've got your WPL, you've got your 100, and you've got your Big Bash, and you know, obviously there's CPL, there's PSL a little bit. So hopefully there's a South African T20 league as well that can run off the back of things. Who knows? Fingers crossed. But I just really think that it's going to take a lot of teamwork and unity in terms of making sure that we can make that all fit, because I guess the other challenge that, you know, to me is pretty obvious, but is the financial aspect to it as well. Is, you know, I don't think I'm speaking out of turn here, but we know that the English, the Australians are really well paid from an international perspective, and that is really varied between countries. And so the opportunity to go play in the WPL or the 100, you know, sometimes that money is too good to pass up, you know, for what you're doing. So you've got to be realistic about it. So unless there's some sort of input or support from, whether it's the ICC, I mean, I don't know, but I'd love there to be sort of a level playing field in terms of not reimbursement, but do you know what I mean? Just some sort of, some sort of even level there it gives everyone a fair chance of things, I guess, is what I'm trying to say.
Just as a last thing, Sophie, you said something there which just caught my ear, because you said you would love to see tours where they're playing a test match per tour. And I know that you haven't played a test, but it's a conversation piece we have around women's cricket so much, in that, like, is there enough preparation for tests? You know, we saw South Africa and Australia play a test there where South Africa was just completely blown out the water, and they'd only played, you know, two tests in 9 years or something like that. I mean, do you really want to play test cricket? And if so, why? And also, what can be done so that if you played one, you'd be as ready as you could be?
Yeah, I think there's a lot of parts to it. I would love to play a test match, and that's because I'm a cricketer. I've grown up with test cricket, watching it. And I'd love to test myself at that level and playing, you know, over 4 or 5 days. I think that'll be an incredible challenge. I think there's obviously a lot of difficulties, though, and I guess this is where I need to put my realistic hat on, in terms of we're talking about a crammed schedule and where are you going to find time to be able to prepare? Because at the end of the day, if you're going to play, you need to do it properly, and you need to give yourself the best chance to perform. As you say, I think in saying that, it is. It's up to each board and each country in terms of whether they bring that in domestically. I know here in India that they're going to start playing, I think, multi-day cricket, which is fantastic. But each country's in such a different position to be able to offer that opportunity. I think it's a really tricky one. I would love to play test cricket, and I would love every country to play test cricket, and I would love there to be domestic setups that support test cricket. Whether that's realistic, I'm not too sure. And where the game's going, not just in the women's, but in the men's space too, is, you know, we're crunched for time as it is, and we haven't got too much test cricket going on. So, I'm really conflicted, because I would absolutely love to play a game. Just one would be enough for me, but how that fits in the grand scheme of things, it's probably where I need to, have a bit of perspective and know that there's a lot that has to go in behind the scenes to organise and to have the structure in place to make it really worthwhile.
Oh, Sophie, thank you very much. Before we let you go, we have a very quick little quiz whereby we're going to ask you to build your perfect cricketer. You can choose male or female from any country based on some criteria that I'm going to give you now. Are you ready?
Yep.
Power hitting, who have you got?
In my mind, I was like, I'm going to go all female athletes, but I'm going to go Aaron Finch.
Nice one. Catching.
Who never drops them? I'm going to go Nat Silverbrant.
Ground fielding.
Oh, I'm going to go Aaron Burns.
Death bowling.
Oh, death bowling. Far out. You're really testing us out here. who have we got? Oh my gosh. I'm like racking through so many different players going through my head. Well, I'm gonna have to go Nat Sivabrant again.
Awesome. Variations.
Oh, who do we like with that? I'm gonna go a bit rogue. I'm gonna go Mely Kerr. Obviously her googly is pretty special, so we'll go with her.
Nice. Innovation.
Oh, innovation. I love watching Joss Butler. I think he plays some absolutely ridiculous shots. So I'll go Joss.
And the last one, who is your best tactician?
Oh, this is a toss-up between Rachel Haynes, and I think I'm going to have to go Meg Lanning.
Yeah, Lanning's been popular actually, and you've done really well on getting a good number of females in there. That's impressive. That's
Yes,
great.
thank you.
Oh, thank you so much for your time, Sophie. It's been wonderful to speak to you, and we really appreciate it and wish you all the very best for what's ahead.
Awesome. Thanks a lot, guys. Really appreciate it.
Endless night, ember hot and icy cold. The rage of the earth. We made this curse. Carved it in the blood on our backs. We did not see. We could not, but she did. And in the end,
what will I become?
Senua Saga, Hellblade 2.
Play it now with Game Pass.
Well, that was great to hear from Sophie there, and she'll be riding pretty high after RCB's success in that WPL final. Just before we start unpicking all of that, I think we need to speak about a little bit of success of our own here at ESPN Crick Info. Firdaus Mundar has got a long list nomination, our very own, for the AIPS, International Sports Press Association Awards. It's for a column that was one of my favourite pieces of last year. I can't change my body structure. Everybody is not going to be slim. Effectively about fat shaming in cricket, to put it bluntly. For those, huge congratulations on that long list nomination. Can you just sort of quickly, let us know a tiny little bit about the piece? If anyone hasn't read it, they can go and check it out. But I know it was a really important piece for you to write. Can you just tell us a little bit about that?
Yes, thank you so much, Val, because it's such an honor to be on the long list. It's a piece that was gnawing at me for a long time. I'm also a yoga teacher and do a lot of research into the politics of the body, which I think people will know. And in fact, it was Rakeem Cornwall who inspired the piece when I saw him playing in a test match about 4 years ago and just heard the way that the commentators were speaking about him, the language they were using. I felt really bad for him. You know, I just thought, this is terrible for this guy to be just so shamed for what he looks like. And he was one of the people that I interviewed, along with Azam Khan from Pakistan, who told a heartbreaking story of posting the little names that he was called, writing it on post-its and sticking it on the wall, things like elephant and potato, just awful, awful stuff. So I wanted to shed light on that and also on the fitness requirements. It came up at the time that South Africa's T20 Women's World Cup squad was affected by Danai van Niekerk's absence because she was unable to run the 2 kilometer time trial in 10 minutes 30. So yeah, it was bringing together all those things. But we've had a double success with the AIPS Awards because our young colleague, and I have to say young, because Shruti Ravindranath has been longlisted in the young reporters category, the under 30. And yes, there are people who are under 30. She's been longlisted in that category for her piece on women's health in cricket, which was a really interesting piece done around the WPL last year. And she looked at things like the menstrual cycle, eating orders and disorders, and how people work around that. And it's a fantastic scientifically researched piece with insights from Cricket South Africa's chief of medical, Dr. Shueb Manjra, really bringing in some important insights into health in cricket. And that's what we spoke to Sophie Devine about as well. You know, the best part of that conversation for me was hearing about her being such an open diabetic, not just because Dusra's a diabetic, but I've now mentioned that twice. But she spoke about, you know, people getting to know the equipment, the insulin. She was so fabulous and open in that conversation. Now, I wonder what you thought of that.
Yeah, I really liked that a lot. It was really enlightening to hear, you know, her really clear desire to educate people about her condition, and also to remember that it's not as uncommon as we thought within cricket. She mentioned Hayley Matthews there as well, and even within the New Zealand setup, Jess Kerr. So she sort of got someone to chat to at home within the team. So it was just really interesting to learn, whilst it's not that widely spoken about, it is a, you know, relatively common condition, and just her being so welcoming of questions and wanting to sort of share and educate people. And it really struck me when she said, you know, the more that people ask and know, the better, because, you know, I might find myself in trouble one day, and if the message is out there and people know what to do, then, you know, that's only going to be a good thing. So I found that really, really fascinating. It was brilliant to talk to her about that.
Yeah, it really was. And also, she had a wonderful WPL. She started off in the middle order. I remember you and I, it was that last league game, or was it actually the qualifier, I think, that RCB played. And I said, oh, goodness, they've promoted her up the order. And is this really the time to be getting funky? Because my money was on Mumbai Indians, and my very own homegirl, Shabnam Ismail. I really wanted them to do well. But this is my fate to every team that I punt to do well, ends up not doing well. And it turned out to be a masterstroke for RCB, in that not just her performance, but Smriti Mandana, I thought, led them exceptionally well. They've had such a good coming together. Their bowlers, Asha Sabana, has been so good. Shreyanka Patel as well has been really good. I wonder what you think of their progression. They certainly weren't the favourites by any means when we spoke about this about a month ago.
No, there's so much to unpack there. I have to admit, I did not see that coming as far as RCB. I mean, I considered that to be an upset. Delhi Capitals had looked the stronger side throughout the group stages. You know, that obviously had the wood on RCB in their head-to-heads. But having watched RCB in that eliminator, there was an element of, don't write them off. The way they managed to beat the defending champions, Mumbai Indians, in that eliminator, they just never gave up. And if that could, you know, sort of see them through that match, then that was going to be something to carry through to the final. And sure enough, we saw that come to pass. But I think with Sophie Devine, she probably had a slightly quieter tournament than she would have liked by her standards. As you mentioned, she started opening for RCB. She dropped down to sort of number four, where she has batted for New Zealand in the format, and then back up to the top. And it was, it was just a very unsell top of the order. Smriti Mandana notwithstanding, she was a constant there and had a wonderful, wonderful tournament for them. Really led from the front. But I guess Sophie Devine sort of opening in that final, I think her 27 ball 32 was her highest of the tournament. So, you know, it came at the right time. But I think also too, you can't talk about RCB's batting without mentioning Elise Perry. What a tournament she had. And I just find her tournament so fascinating, in the sense that, and somewhat 18 months ago, leading into the Commonwealth Games, she couldn't even get into that Australian lineup in the T20s. She was coming back off a back injury, so she was just playing as a batter only at that stage. But her strike rate had come into question, and she seems to just sort of, you know, taken all of that and reinvented herself, and to be the leading run scorer in the WPL, and, you know, some of the match turning innings that she produced, not to mention then with the ball, a six for, you know, that was, you know, just incredible. She just kept giving to that team. And you sort of mentioned, I think, Shreyanka Patil as well. I mean, she was wonderful for them. And I think they interviewed Elise Perry at the presentation, and she said the future's, you know, in her hands. And you really felt that when you saw her. I mean, she seemed like such a character and such a great player. And, I think the future ahead is really, really bright for her. Did anyone else in the tournament stand out to you as, you know, having really, you know, a brilliant time, or someone to look out for in tournaments to come?
Yeah, two things, actually. The one thing is that Shreyanka Patel was playing with a hairline fracture in her left hand throughout the tournament. So the future's definitely in her hands. And we can see that even with her having this injury, which, of course, it was a non-bowling hand, but to still perform match after match and to end up as the leading wicket taker with that was just so incredible. She's 21 years old. So I think that leads into my broader point, that what we saw was a lot of young Indian players with an immense amount of potential. Shefali Verma, we sort of know, she's a known quantity to us, but she had a very good tournament as well. And then Shabnam Shakil, 16 years old and quick and aggressive with a fantastic bouncer. I think she is really a player that we're going to see so much of in the future. I was very impressed by her. I also interviewed Saima Takur from the New P Warriors. She's not actually that young. She's 27 years old, but she's got this amazing story of having started off playing football. She wanted to be a goalkeeper, and then they ended up having a national goalkeeper in the side. She had to become a striker. Then she started to play cricket. She comes from very, very humble beginnings. Her dad is a driver, and she really wants to play international cricket. I found just from chatting to her, and her drive and her desire and her passion was so massive that I think India is starting to tap into these younger players, unknown players, players who come from backgrounds that we wouldn't normally associate with the progression of the Indian team. You know, when we look at the men's team, by the time they get there, they're such known quantities. They've played for a while. Even those who do come from difficult circumstances, like a Mohammad Siraj or the Pandyas, for example. But that's the one thing that stood out for me. And then the second thing that stood out to me is how the big international names are still the ones that are dominating performance. So we had Meg Lanning right up there leading the run scoring for much of the tournament before she was leapfrogged by Elise Perry. We've got Sophie Molyneux, Sophie Eccleston in among the top wicket takers. Marizan Kapp was there and thereabouts as well. So it's maybe a slight concern that you're still seeing this dominance of foreign players. I wonder if it's similar to the early editions of the IPL, you know, if you think back to 2008 or 2009, when it was really Australian players that were dominating at that time. And then as the years went on and as the depth of Indian cricket began to get exposed to this type of level, we saw an up-leveling of the local players as well. Maybe that's coming, especially with the younger players, and maybe it's not that concerning, but you want to see different names performing, I suppose.
Yeah, for sure. And I guess that's the part of the point of having these big franchise leagues is, you know, one of the legacy selling points is that it's going to build the depth of the host country. So I guess, you know, we've seen WBBL, I mean, that was sort of built on a pretty solid domestic structure for the Australian women, but that has also, you know, really seen Australia forge further ahead again. So, I mean, perhaps, you know, we're going to see that again. I mean, it was, it is a very slick competition, the WPL, but it is only in its, you know, its second year. And it's just that balance, isn't it? As you say, of getting those big international draw cards, and they've done, you know, very, very well with that. To also, you know, introducing, you know, up and coming local, you know, talent. So yeah, I think that's just something that perhaps will happen organically as the tournament goes ahead. I guess one other thing that struck me about the WPL was the quality of some of the contests. Sort of, we started the whole thing with those two absolute nail biters, and then there were several more during the course of the tournament. That eliminator, sort of RCB, just got across the line in the final over. And again, whilst, you know, in the final, they only had a really small target, 114 to chase down. It was only, you know, achieved in that last over. So, it, you know, it wasn't like it was, you know, as easy as it looked like it was going to be. So I just thought the quality of the contests and the sides, you know, being matched up really well was a really great draw card. Did you have any sort of takes on that as well?
Yeah, I thought it was a better tournament than last year's. I thought we had more closer games. I'm still sort of in my mind wondering, what do UP and Gujarat Giants have to do to get off the bottom of the table, especially Gujarat Giants, because things just don't seem to work for them. And they've got proper players in there. You know, they've got Beth Mooney, Laura Wolfart. Like, I don't really know what it is that's not clicking for them. I haven't picked up too much of it yet. UP, I think, were right in there and will be mighty disappointed with the way that they lost their final league game, because I really thought that they could have done better as well. I wonder if there's something to be said for having a local leader, you know, like we saw with Smriti Mandana, versus having a foreign captain, like with a Beth Mooney. I don't know if there's something in there for maybe the sides to think about. And I also think maybe we'll see some radical changes to those two squads between this edition of the tournament and the next one. Overall, I really enjoyed it, though. And I also thought it was the perfect length, because we're about to go into a men's IPL that is going to last for almost 2 months. And I'm not against things lasting for 2 months. But I think having this length of tournament, it kept us engaged for, you know, just over 3 weeks. We were there and thereabouts, and we enjoyed it so much. And now we can sort of go off and enjoy other things, which is wonderful in a sense. I guess my one thing is moving the games around. Because did you think Bangalore and Delhi were the best venues for the quality of cricket we want to see?
I guess, I mean, one encouraging thing was that there was good local support for the team that wasn't from that place in sort of both cases. So in a way, that was really nice to see. But yeah, I think, again, as the tournament grows and that kind of thing, moving it around, I think, would be a great idea sort of even further. Couldn't agree with you more on those other two points you made. I think UP Warriors were a big disappointment for me because on paper they are a cracking side. And, you know, they did have some good performances, but I just felt like they should have done a little bit better. But also to the length of the tournament, I think the key there was that it left you wanting a little bit more. And that's what you want. You don't want to be going on where, you know, too long. So I think it was the perfect length. And I suppose that brings us to the fact that those players involved have now shot off to their respective countries, those that are involved in bilateral series. The Australians heading to Bangladesh for a series there, but also to, as we mentioned, our guest Sophie Devine, she is, headed for New Zealand now to take on England. So both of those sides will be waiting on players to arrive. But they'll be starting, you know, without some of their biggest names. But I guess one thing that was really interesting that Sophie was talking about was just New Zealand women's cricket and sort of what's going on there. And basically she's saying that, you know, this series against England could be a bit of a benchmark to see how far they've come, not under any illusions that there's not a lot more work to be done, you know, coming off the back of that T20 World Cup disappointment last year and with another one toward the end of this year. So it's just sort of really interesting to hear what she had to say about that. And I guess one interesting thing is that the core of the New Zealand squad is pretty much the same, a few ins and outs. But yeah, the players that were there in South Africa last year are largely still there. And then it's a case of sort of, you know, developing more as they go. But what do you think we're going to see come out of this series against England from, you know, I guess from both teams' perspective with half an eye on that World Cup already toward the end of this year?
Yeah, I'm really interested in looking at what Sophie Devine was hinting at when she spoke about depth in New Zealand. And I must be honest, I was quite surprised when she said our depth is not where we want it to be. I guess when we, from the outside in South Africa, look at New Zealand with its first world structures and its equal pay long before us and all those kinds of things, we think, oh no, they must be flying. But maybe, you know, she mentioned netball and she mentioned rugby union as two other sports that are drawing or attracting female athletes. Netball, for sure, I can totally see that. I covered the Netball World Cup last year and New Zealand were out of this world good. So I can definitely see that. I don't know if it pays as well as something like cricket. So that would be interesting to know. And I guess now it's for New Zealand, it's almost a changing of the guard, isn't it? Where you're probably going to see Sophie Devine, perhaps even... Who am I thinking of? Susie Bates. Start to maybe look to transition out. I know, like, we told Sophie that 34 was young, which it is, but she's been playing for such a long time that we really need to now see what the younger talent bring to the table. And England, I think, are in such an opposite position. You're right there, so you might know better than I will. But they just seem to produce players. They've got this great system. You were telling me the other day about the professionalization of the women's game with these teams applying now to be the new counties, if I understand correctly. They do seem like probably after Australia, the next most professional outfit. And so maybe almost worryingly, are we going to see the gap widen between an England, Australia and all the rest? So South Africa, Sri Lanka also start next week. And I just want to pick on that as a point because that will also show us depth. South Africa have got 16-year-old Karabo Miso, picked as the wicketkeeper, putting a lot of pressure on Sanalo Jafta, who, charismatic as she is, sometimes has poor games and, you know, bats very low down the order. So that'll be interesting to see pan out. South Africa lost to Zimbabwe at the Africa Games in the Super Over, believe it or not. It was it wasn't a very strong South African side. It was a very strong Zimbabwean side. Zimbabwe won gold at the game. So it's just interesting to sort of see how the depth shows itself. And Sri Lanka, of course, we'll want to look at from that perspective as well. But are you similarly concerned that England could be pulling ahead, or am I being too optimistic on that front?
No, no, not at all. I think England seem to be moving very quickly and making changes very quickly where they see that's needed. That's what some of this restructure, again, of the women's domestic game here in England is about. So they just underwent a massive restructure, coming out of COVID, had the 50-over competition and the 20-over competition with regional sides. They're now moving away from a regional structure and bringing it back to the counties. And that's for a few reasons. So basically, some of those regional sides had a bit of an identity crisis, because they were drawing from several different counties and there wasn't sort of, it was all new and it's not from a particular place. Also, too, a lot of the, they're all centrally funded by the ECB, whereas sending it back to the county, so there'll be 8 teams still competing in the top level or tier one, but they will be they're currently in the process of being bid for by those of the existing 18 first class counties who put in a bid, and only 2 didn't. So there's basically 16 counties putting in a bid for 8 top tier teams. And the idea being that, one, it is identifiable with a place, an existing club in many cases, ones that have got years and years and years of history behind them. And also, too, they will link up more closely with existing men's teams who, again, have been playing for years and years and years and years. And so they can sort of work on marketing opportunities together. There's talk of double headers, that kind of thing, which we've seen in the 100 work well. So, it's all being mapped out literally as we speak. The deadline for tenders only closed just over a week ago. We're yet to see, but we will find out this season because this is going to be in place next season. So you see, again, it's all changing pretty quickly because they've identified an area where they want to make changes and improvements, and so they've gone for it. So that's all sort of up in the air at the minute, but that's sort of an illustration of how quickly things are moving here. One other thing to, I think, note, which Sophie Devine pointed out, was New Zealand have a tiny population of 5 million odd people compared to, the UK, compared to even, Australia. So, India, etc., South Africa. So we forget how tiny a country they are. So in terms of, drawing on a talent pool and one that's competing hugely with netball, it's massive there, and rugby union, it's a really big task for them. So yeah, I guess there is that risk of the gap widening. She did sound very positive, Sophie Devine, when she was talking about, the right moves being made by New Zealand cricket. But I guess also too, she's very pragmatic. These things do take time. We're talking generational changes here. So, the fact that it's sort of happening quickly here in England, one, they've got a big population resource to work with there. They've got big financial resources to work with there. So that is, likely to happen. But yeah, it will be really interesting to see how these two sides match up, New Zealand and England. And then, yeah, going forward, what New Zealand have got to work with.
Yeah, I reckon it's advantage England from everything that you've said and described. I would be surprised, I suppose, if New Zealand were to win both series. I have to be careful what I say because my predictions are always wrong. Maybe this means New Zealand are just going to win everything, actually. But I hope it'll be competitive. Of course, it'll be the middle of the night for you and very close to the middle of the night for me as well, to be keeping an eye on those games. But we're looking forward to a competitive one. Of course, South Africa, Sri Lanka happening at the same time. Australia, Bangladesh as well, which I think will be really interesting given how much Bangladesh have progressed and what Nigar Sultana Jyoti told us on our previous podcast about how they're ready to take on big names and big teams and to really make a statement ahead of their home World Cup, which will be later this year. So there's lots of women's cricket going on, international bilateral series. And although we seem to think of this window as a time which is dominated by franchise cricket and the presence of the IPL means that that is the case, I think for supporters and followers of women's cricket, this is a very interesting period. There's one more thing I want to mention, which is in April, The Women's T20 World Cup qualifiers will be taking place in Abu Dhabi, and there's some really interesting teams to look out for there. Zimbabwe will be among them. We'll see Thailand, who we saw competing at the Women's T20 World Cup a couple of years ago as well. They will be there. So two spots up for grabs for that Bangladesh T20 World Cup, and I'm really looking forward to that.
Can't wait. There's so much to look forward to. Until then, thank you so much for listening on ESPN Cricket Info Power Play, Women's Cricket Uncut.